This Thursday, journalist Masha Gessen joined us to talk about the challenges facing people who are trying to change political and social conditions in Russia. So for this week's Bonus Weekend podcast, we've chosen three interviews from a couple of years ago that highlighted people who were trying to expose wrongdoings in Russia. In February 2015, investor Bill Browder talked about his attorney, Sergei Magnitsky, who, after exposing corruption in Russia, was tortured and then later died in prison. In November 2015, chess champion Garry Kasparov discussed his book about Vladimir Putin's anti-democratic tendencies. And also that month, I spoke with journalist Marvin Kalb about the Russian invasion of Crimea. Enjoy. By the 1980s, the economy of the Soviet Union was falling apart, and Mikhail Gorbachev thought demonopolization was an essential solution. So he promoted the policy of perestroika, the reconstruction of the Soviet political and economic system. And it was an exciting time, full of opportunities, but the way the country's most precious resources were sold off led to even more problems and a lot of corruption. Bill Browder was a witness to it all, as he reveals in his new book, Red Notice, a true story of high finance, murder, and one man's fight for justice. It's an insider's account of the extreme hazards of trying to do business in post-Soviet Russia. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You begin your book by saying you're a numbers guy, and you throw out three numbers, 260 to 1 and 4.5. Billion. What did they mean?
Well, 206. So one was my one son at the time, who I was divorced from his mother, and I was living in Moscow. He and his mother lived in London, and I was flying back and forth every other weekend to see him from Moscow, where I lived. 260 was the number of round trips that I had taken to Russia, and 4.5 billion was the amount of money I was managing in the Russian stock market at the time.
You write about how incredible your journey into high finance was, especially considering your family background. Now, you were a red diaper baby?
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know it, a red diaper baby is my grandfather, Earl Browder, was the general secretary of the American Communist Party.
So famous communists.
He was on the cover of Time magazine, ran for president against Roosevelt twice, was arrested and put in jail. There were protests to get him out of jail, etc. He was then kicked out of the Communist Party. He was persecuted during the McCarthy era. And then I was born in the mid-1960s. And I was going through my teenage rebellion, as many teenagers do. And so what do you do when you want to rebel from a family of communists? Well, in my case, I put on a suit and tie and became a capitalist.
Your parents met at MIT. They were both academics, but also outspoken politically?
Not outspoken politically, but as one might guess, most academics are left-leaning to start out with, and coming from a family of communists, perhaps more left-leaning than the average family. And so at the dinner table, it was sort of beaten into me that all businessmen were crooks.
That everybody here was an academic, except you. Your brother excelled academically as well. What were the problems for you? Why were you struggling at school?
Well, so I come from a family where my father went to MIT at the age of 14, he was had his PhD by the time he was 21. My brother, pretty much the same thing. And so, in my family, if you weren't a prodigy, there was something wrong with you. And so, I was just a regular kid, and so I was sort of looking for my place in the world, and it wasn't in academia.
But at the same time, it wound up being in numbers.
Well, I think that genetically in my family, somehow we all are facile with numbers, and so that's how I ended up getting interested in money and finance and so on.
University of Chicago, got a BA in economics, then an MBA from Stanford. When did you first move to London? How did you wind up going from there to working in London?
So I was at Stanford Business School. I was graduating in 1989. And at the time, everybody who comes out of business school, the main purpose of business school is to sort of figure out what job you're going to have afterwards. And so I was searching my soul to find the job that was right for me. And none of the normal recruiting on campus seemed all that interesting. And then I had an epiphany, which was that my grandfather was the largest communist in America and the Berlin Wall was coming down, why don't I go out and become the largest capitalist in Eastern Europe? And so I moved to London to set out to do that.
Working for the Salomon Brothers.
Well, I originally worked for Boston Consulting Group, and then I had another job, and then I ended up at Salomon Brothers just at the beginning of the Russian privatization program. And this was the time when they decided to give all the state assets away for free to the people, and then there was this chaotic new market.
Not just in Russia. It was all throughout Eastern Europe, but some countries handled it better than others.
So it all started, actually, I started investing in Poland before Russia, and Poland was much more responsible about this whole thing. They didn't sort of give all state assets away for free, nor did Hungary, or the Czech Republic was more like the Russians. But the Russians just did it willy-nilly. And the thing about Russia, which made it a bit sort of difficult for everybody, was it was kind of like building a house, a beautiful house, but without putting the plumbing and electricity in. So they created capitalism, but they didn't have any laws or property rights. And so they gave everything away for free, and then it was then a free-for-all.
And then they didn't have a stock market.
Well, they had a stock market. The stock market was just a bunch of guys with telephones phoning each other, and more importantly, they didn't have any rights or laws. And so if you owned a share of something, it didn't really mean anything because the guy who controlled the company could, so he'd take 100% of the stuff for himself, even if you owned a share, it didn't mean anything.
I always wondered how certain people wound up getting these companies. Was it just that they were in the KGB, or they were highly placed in the company to begin with, so they had the inside track?
It was sort of pure rotten corruption from the very beginning. There are 22 oligarchs who ended up owning a vast majority of, or about 40% of the country.
Well, had they been powerful when it was the Soviet Union?
No, it was pure corruption. So what happened was you had these guys, they set up banks. The central bank said anyone can have a bank now. And so a few guys set up banks and they went to the ministers of, let's say, the minister of defense and said, if you put all your ministry's money at my bank with no interest, then I'll put $10 million in a Swiss account for you. And then the banker, the guy who paid that $10 million bribe, would take that money and then buy government bonds. And the government bonds at the time had 100% interest rate because of the inflation. And so all of a sudden, let's say that he put $200 million in their bank, the banker would get $200 million of interest, and the Ministry of Defense money would be in half.
Now, the corruption was in Russia, but it also was at Salomon Brothers, wasn't it? Hadn't some Salomon traders just gotten into trouble with the SEC before you started there?
Well, so what happened was Salomon in 1991 had tried to rig the treasury bond market, and there was a famous situation where Warren Buffett had to step in and take over the firm, and it was only because of that scandal that they had a lot of guys had quit, and so it allowed me to get a job there. It wasn't an easy place to get a job beforehand, and so that was where I was able. That was why I was able to get a job at the time.
How did you convince Salomon Brothers to give you $25 million to invest in Russia?
Well, it wasn't an easy situation. So I went out to Russia first off, and I discovered that this mass privatization program was going on, and I discovered that they were selling shares, or I should say, the shares were trading on the market at a 99.7% discount to the price of shares in the West.
And it was a voucher exchange rather than a real stock market.
Well, they started with vouchers, and then the vouchers were exchangeable for shares, and the shares that they were exchangeable for traded at this ridiculously low discount. And so I go back to the guys at Salomon, and I say, hey, you know, they're basically giving away money for free. You can buy these shares for nothing, and, you know, if, you know, you can, we can make 10 or 20 times our money. And at first, nobody wanted to listen to me because I was talking about Russia, and Russia had such a negative connotation. They couldn't get beyond the name Russia before we got into the numbers. And so everybody sort of said no until I came across one guy in the New York office who heard about me, and he said, okay, yeah, let's take a look at this stuff.
My guest is Bill Browder, who's written a book called Red Notice, a true story of high finance, murder, and one man's fight for justice. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You were really the only one who was noticing that this situation could lead to big money?
Well, I wouldn't say I was the only one. I would say I was one of the only ones. There was probably like 10 people out there at the time, but in terms of Westerners on the ground, very, very few.
Still, people's misgivings are understandable. The whole situation sounds like an invitation to commit fraud. Were you nervous about investing the money?
Well, so I looked at it as there was sort of a 50-50 thing. So I thought there was about a 50% chance that we would lose all our money. And then I thought there was a 50% chance that we would make 10 or 20 times our money. And I said to everybody, you know, this is a total gamble. Let's roll the dice. If we make 10 or 20 times the money, great. If we lose it, don't put enough in so that it makes a big difference. And so I was able to raise money from investors to do that.
And the first $25 million turned into $125 million.
So the first $25 million that Solomon gave me turned into $125 million. And then all of a sudden, they started taking me around to visit with all of the important clients of Solomon Brothers. And everybody said, you know, what you're doing sounds absolutely fascinating. Can we give you some money to manage? I go back to the guys at Solomon and I say, hey, can we manage money for these outside clients? And the bosses say, great idea. Let's form a task force to study it. And I show up at the first task force meeting, and there's like 40 people in the room. Most of them I've never seen before, and they're all fighting with each other and arguing about who is going to get the economic credit for the business. And I looked around and heard all these great arguments, and I thought, I don't know who's going to win, but I know who for sure is not going to get any economic credit, and that's going to be me.
So you left Solomon Brothers.
So I left Solomon, and I set up my own firm called Hermitage, and moved to Moscow in 1996.
Now Hermitage is. Of course, the name of the museum in St. Petersburg, not in Moscow.
No,
is that what you were naming it after?
Well, I thought the name Hermitage sort of was symbolic of where they kept the treasures in Russia, so I thought that would be a nice name for my investment management firm, and so I called it the Hermitage Capital Management, and it's also easy to pronounce in English and in Russian. Everyone knows the name, and so it was a good name for a firm.
Doing business in foreign countries can be dangerous. Hadn't a former Stanford schoolmate Zhu Chao gotten into trouble with authorities in China in 1998 for not agreeing to pay a $60,000 bribe to an official? What happened to him?
Well, that was a really terrible story. So this young man, he was a Chinese-American, went to Stanford a few years after me, went to set up a medical supply business in China, and got shaken down and just didn't want to get involved in corruption. And so he was arrested, and he was sentenced without any kind of fair trial or without any opportunity to defend himself to something like 17 years in prison. And it was a real shocking story.
And yet you write China was 10 times safer than Russia when it came to doing business.
Well, indeed it was. And my own experience as it played itself out showed that very profoundly, unfortunately.
But you didn't know it at the time?
Well,
what did you think was going on?
So when I went out there, I thought that Russia was a sort of chaotic, dangerous place in the same way as the south side of Chicago where I grew up, which is that if you just, you know, kept your head down, didn't go into the bad neighborhoods, didn't flaunt anything, you know, that you could live a comfortable and safe life. And for a while, that was true in Russia, that the danger was for the people who, like, had a jewelry store where the guys with the leather jackets would show up trying to get money. But I was, you know, sitting in an anonymous office trading stocks, and for a long time, no one had any idea who I was or what I was. And so for a long time, I was sort of under the radar screen.
This is when Boris Yeltsin was in power?
Yeah, so from 1996 for the next few years, I was completely under the radar screen. And nobody bothered me, and I was just, you know, living in an apartment, going to work, and doing my business without any trouble.
You go into some detail about your first investors. Who were they, and why did they trust you with all this money?
Well, the main investor was a very famous man at the time named Edmund Safra. Mm-hmm. Edmund Safra.
He had Republic National Bank.
Right. He was the owner of Republic National Bank. He was a Lebanese Jew who had been all over the world and had really sort of knew about difficult markets. And I met him at his villa in the south of France when I was still at Solomon Brothers, and told him the story about Russia. And I think he saw in me sort of himself maybe 30 years earlier exploring this new market. And so he made a bet on me and put up the first $25 million for my fund.
Now, he died under rather shocking circumstances, burned to death, locked into his hotel room, if I remember correctly. But that is not connected in any way to the Russian story, is it?
No, no. That was connected to its own horrific tragedy. He was there was a nurse working for him who set off a fire in his house, and I guess to try to then save him from this fire, but it didn't work, and he ended up dying of smoke inhalation in what was supposed to be his safe room. And that was 1999, and a terrible blow to everyone who knew him.
Including you, I imagine, since he was a major investor. What was the political situation like in Russia at the time? Wasn't there a feeling that it might very well go back, that one of the major political candidates was a former communist, and he was appealing to the nostalgia for the old communist system in this period of chaos?
So when I first got started with the fund, so I started the fund in 1996, and there was a presidential election just getting going at that point. And it was Yeltsin who was the president at the time, the incumbent.
With a very low approval rating.
He was running against a guy named Gennady Zhuganov, who's still actually in the political picture. So Yeltsin at the time started out with like a 5% approval rating, and Zhuganov was maybe 25 or 30% approval rating. And so going into the election in the summer of 1996, everybody thought that that Zhuganov would win. And if Zhuganov won, his big pledge was that he was going to end this whole experiment with capitalism. And so everybody was sitting on the edge of their seats wondering if the whole capitalist experiment was going to end. And it was only not ending because of these oligarchs, the ones who had been enriched by Yeltsin, all kind of got together with each other instead of fighting with each other, and started working with Yeltsin to use all of the media resources they had to basically turn the election around, which steadily and slowly they did, to the point where by the time July 1996 came around, Yeltsin won with more than 50% of the vote.
How was the Russian economy doing in 1996?
It was doing very, very badly. So the whole sort of move from communism to capitalism had effectively just destroyed the economy. Maybe, we're not talking about a recession or a depression. We're talking about a deep depression, where the size of the economy drops by half, and the average person who is living a middle-class life is living in destitute poverty.
We're hearing about a similar situation today, but it's probably not as bad.
In America, you mean?
No, I'm talking about in Russia.
In Russia,
we have other kinds of problems.
In Russia, it may not be as bad, but it may be as bad. We don't know. I mean, we're just getting going in this whole situation in Russia today.
Still, by 1997, the Hermitage Fund was ranked the best performing fund in the world.
Yeah, so I bought all these cheap shares, and I was on the ground in Russia, and most of the people who I was competing with were doing this from New York or London or Geneva. And so I had this amazing ability, and it wasn't like I was immensely smarter than anyone else. I could just go and ask the questions down at the companies, which other people didn't have the opportunity to do. And it was all, sometimes you just show up and ask a question, and it was there right for you to see that how undervalued a certain share was.
You spoke Russian?
I didn't speak Russian, no.
So you had to do all this through translators.
I had a bunch of very, very clever young Russian employees who all came with me to these meetings and helped me translate and helped me decipher all the data, which made all the difference for me.
Your fund was performing 718% up from its inception, but then the next year you sustained a 90% drop.
Yeah, so It was sort of the glory days for the first 2 years, I was the sort of poster boy of success and adventure and financial adventure in Russia, up almost 10 times, just a spectacular thing. Then in 1998, the Russian government defaulted on their bonds. They devalued their currency by 75%, and the stock market went down 90%, and I had $1 billion under management, lost $900 million. It was on a financial basis, one of the most shocking things that can happen to an investor who was with me and certainly to me managing their money.
And then other things happened. We'll take a little break. We'll come back and talk about Vladimir Putin and talk about the tragic side of this story that you tell in your book. My guest is Bill Browder. His book, Red Notice, A True Story of High Finance, Murder, and One Man's Fight for Justice, published by Simon & Schuster. We're back with Bill Browder, founder and CEO of Hermitage Capital Management, until 2005, the largest foreign investor in Russia. Previously, he was a vice president at Salomon Brothers. His book, Red Notice, a true story of high finance, murder, and one man's fight for justice, is published by Simon & Schuster. By 2000, a lot of people had given up making money in Russia and they'd left. Why did you stay?
Well, by 2000, things actually had started to really, it was one of these things where it couldn't get any cheaper. The market after the crash of 1998, everything was just so cheap that I thought the only direction was up. And also, what I had investments in oil companies, and the oil companies were making money. And so I thought that, you know, if I just stayed, everything would recover.
Your fund had lost 90%. The oligarchs are trying to steal the remaining 10%. That was the people at Gazprom, the oil company?
Well, so people were trying to steal at all the companies. So basically, after the default of 98, there was no longer any incentive to behave yourself if you're a Russian oligarch. And so these bad guys started to steal in every different company. The company, the biggest company and the biggest stealing in Russia was Gazprom.
Who was there?
So it was run by a guy named Rem Vyakarev, who was sort of the red director, this old sort of Soviet guy. And he was really running a big scam where they were transferring assets off the balance sheet to his family members and friends and colleagues. And we said to ourselves, we need to stop the stealing somehow. But how do you stop the stealing in a Russian company? You couldn't go to the police or the politicians because they weren't interested in that.
And you talk about the mindset that you were having to deal with in a story. You were driving to go play tennis with a friend who was driving, and he didn't want to stop when he saw someone injured on the road.
Yeah, so one of the things that, you know, we were driving along. It was a Saturday morning. I was going to play tennis. My driver was driving along, and there was this what looked like a duffel bag or something like that. It was a sort of misty morning with snow, and as we came closer, I realized it wasn't a duffel bag at all. It was a man in the middle of the road, and I asked my driver. I said, "Pull over," and he was sort of reluctant to do it. I shouted at him a second time to pull over. We pulled over next to the man, and I hopped out, and when he realized that I was hopping out, he hopped out, and we took this man who was lying prone on the road and put him under put his arms around our shoulders and tried to get him to the other side of the street, away out of harm's way. And we then lowered him down gently onto the snowbank. And just as we were doing that, he started to revive himself. And he was having an epileptic. He had just had an epileptic fit. And at this point, the police show up, and the police start stamping around, and they're absolutely not interested in the man. They're only and there's a small crowd that had gathered. They're only interested in who to blame for whatever might have happened. And so they're sort of stamping around. They come to me, and they realize I'm a foreigner. They don't ask me to do anything. And then they come to my driver, and they accuse him of hitting the man. And the man is at this point protesting, saying, "No, nobody hit me. These nice people dragged me to this, you know, helped me out. The police weren't interested at all." And they got to the point where they were almost going to arrest my driver, and only because he had been a policeman himself was he able to get out of it. And it showed us that in Russia there's no such thing as good Samaritanship. That if you're a good Samaritan, you know, a situation like that, and you're not connected to the police, you might end up 7 years in jail.
Weren't you a big supporter of Vladimir Putin at first? Did you think that he would fix things?
Well, so after the Yeltsin era, after the 22 oligarchs got 45% of the country, 40% of the country, and everyone else lived in poverty, I and everybody else in Russia was desperate for some type of order. And so this guy shows up, Vladimir Putin, with like this completely blank face. And so everybody was trying to, and he said, "I'm going to get rid of the oligarchs." And so,
but he was picked by the oligarchs.
He was picked by the oligarchs, but the moment he came in, he said, "I'm going to get rid of the oligarchs." And so he was starting to do various bits and pieces. And so. And everybody, including myself, you know, kind of looked at his blank face, and you kind of imagined what you wanted to imagine about this guy. And for the first couple of years, he wasn't a disastrous president. And everyone who says that they hated Vladimir Putin from day one is not telling the truth, because for a while he was doing sort of okay-ish stuff. He just changed, or I should say, he got enough confidence, so he changed, and that's when he turned into a monster.
And by 2005, you decided that it was time to leave Russia.
Well, no, I didn't decide that. So by 2005, after all of my corporate governance campaigns to fight corruption in Gazprom and various other companies, they decided that it was time for me to leave Russia. And the Putin regime was flying back to Russia, and they stopped me at Sheremetyevo Airport and expelled me from the country.
Was your fund still operating?
Yeah, I was the largest foreign investor in the country. I had been living there 10 years. I had $4.5 billion invested. It was really a major shock to my whole system.
And then we come to the story of your Russian lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, who was murdered in prison in 2009. What had happened? Was he one of the people running the country while you were away?
No. So what happened was I was kicked out of Russia. The moment that I was kicked out, I realized that when they go after you, they don't go after you just mildly. They go after with extreme prejudice. So I evacuated my staff. I sold all the assets quickly and quietly, and I dusted off my hands and said, thank you very much, end of story. It turned out to be the beginning of the worst nightmare you could ever imagine. After that, the Russian authorities raided my offices, seized all of our documents. And at this point, I hired a young lawyer named Sergei Magnitsky to try to defend me against whatever this crazy raid was. Sergei Magnitsky investigates, and he discovers that the people who had raided the office did so in order to steal $230 million of taxes that we paid from the Russian government. So the police raid our offices, get our documents, use the documents not to steal money from us because we didn't have any money left in the country. They used it to steal $230 million of taxes that we paid from the Russian government, from their own country. And so Sergei, my lawyer, testified against the police officers, thinking that this was a major crime against the country. The president should obviously be interested in this.
Since they were really stealing from the Russian people, they weren't stealing from you.
No. And so he said this has to be in the national interest for them to be prosecuted. And instead of prosecuting anybody, and this was all over the newspapers, it was all properly disclosed everywhere, instead of prosecuting anybody, the police arrested Sergei Magnitsky, my lawyer, and put him in jail and started to torture him to get him to withdraw his testimony.
Well, how would this serve Vladimir Putin?
Well, it serves Vladimir Putin because it turns out, as we'd learned through this whole ordeal, that he's running a criminal enterprise, that basically this is one of many, many scams that he's in charge of, that he probably gets the money from, and he certainly he has to support the people that do this because they're all part of his criminal enterprise. And the way we know for sure that it's a criminal enterprise is that, first of all, this was well known to him and to everybody around him that a huge amount of money was stolen. Secondly, the man who reported it was then arrested. He was tortured in prison for 358 days. And Sergei Magnitsky was then killed in custody.
He was 37 years old.
He was 37 years old. And then afterwards, and we have a huge amount of information about what happened to him in custody. He wrote 450 complaints during his 358 days in detention. And so we know that how he was tortured, who tortured him, what they did, when, how, where, and why. And we figured that should then lead to a prosecution. But instead, the Russian government exonerated everybody involved. They changed the story to say he died of natural causes. And then they promoted and gave special honors to the people who were involved. And then they did something which is most unusual and totally unprecedented, which was they put Sergei Magnitsky himself on trial 3 years after he died in the first ever trial against a dead man in the history of Russia. And they put me on trial as his co-defendant. We were both prosecuted. I was sentenced to 9 years in absentia. Even Stalin didn't put dead people on trial.
One of the things that happened during the Soviet years was that, or I guess even later, people who were living in other countries wound up also in danger. Were you ever worried about your own life?
Yeah.
And your family?
Yeah.
Even though you were in London at the time?
I've been getting death threats on a continuous basis since this whole incident started. The geographical boundaries don't constrain Vladimir Putin and his cronies.
And you think Putin is totally responsible for it all?
Well, I think Putin is sitting at the head of he's the mafia boss. He's the Don. He's the one who everybody has to pay a tribute to. And he's the one who's responsible.
Right now, he's in trouble for other reasons, but very popular with the people of Russia. Despite the fact that this story was told at the time, I guess they just go along with his version of events?
Well, I think if you were to ask most Russians about the Sergei Magnitsky story, most Russians would tell you, the name is extremely well known in Russia, and most Russians would be able to recite to you what happened, but it's a very...
Correctly or the Putin version?
No, correctly. Mm-hmm. What Putin has done, though, is And Sergei Magnitsky's story is not unique. There's literally hundreds of thousands of similar stories.
And Khodorkovsky wound up in jail for going up against...
Khodorkovsky faceless, nameless people every day, left, right, and center. And everybody knows this is going on. And what Putin discovered very recently was that people were getting angry with this whole sort of corrupt mess that he had created. And the people in Ukraine, when they had a similar mess, they got rid of their president, and Putin was desperate not to be gotten rid of. And so his current problems right now, problems of his own making, I should say, of invading Ukraine, have nothing to do with NATO or anything like that. This all has to do with him not wanting the people of Russia to be mad at him. And so the best way to keep people from being mad is to start a war so everybody then starts rooting for the home team again. And that's what he's done with this whole eastern Ukraine.
What do you think about the people who argue that this all has to do with the fact that NATO was encroaching onto his territory? That's the way Putin has also kind of described the situation.
It's complete nonsense. The only people that were encroaching on his territory were the Russian people, who were getting angry with all of this corruption and all this terrible theft of all the resources of the state for the benefit of a very few number of people and the possibility of a revolution.
In the end, do you think it'll be possible for foreigners to do business in Russia without having to deal with corruption, payoffs, and the possibility of being put in jail?
No, it's absolutely not possible. And, you know, people
doesn't that hurt Russia ultimately?
It's terrible for Russia.
Foreign investment greases a lot of the wheels of business.
It's a disaster for Russia. It's a disaster for everybody in Russia. Nobody can start a private company. Nobody can do anything because it will be taken away from you. It will be you'll get put in jail. Anything could happen. And this is the sort of mafia state that Putin has created.
At one point in your own career in Moscow, didn't you sleep in a room with armed bodyguards?
Yeah, unfortunately, when I was in the midst of these big fights over corruption in these Russian companies, I had lots of bodyguards, and it was a very unpleasant situation.
Have you been following the public inquiry into the alleged murder of the former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko?
I wouldn't call it an alleged murder. I'd call it a murder, and I've been following it in great detail. He was the first victim of...
I say alleged because it's my job.
Right. Well, I understand that, but I think this is pretty open and shut, that there was a... this is the first use of radioactive terrorism, and he was a British citizen, Alexander Litvinenko, in London, and so it's shocking what they were willing to do to him.
Do you still fear for yourself?
Well, I mean,
you wrote this book. This can't make Vladimir Putin or any of his supporters very happy.
Well, I wrote this book not out of fear or lack of fear. I wrote this book as a tribute to Sergei Magnitsky, my brave lawyer who stood up for truth and justice and who was savagely tortured and killed for doing so. And I think the world needs to know.
Well, you call the current situation a mafia state. It's also been called the kleptocracy. And the economic situation there is terrible. People are being asked to sacrifice for Vladimir Putin, I guess, nationalism and the fact that many people in Russia love the idea that Crimea has been reclaimed. But still, how long can this be sustained, do you think?
Well, I mean, there's two different models. There's sort of on one side, there's the what I call the Zimbabwe-North Korea model, where things really bad stuff goes on for a really long time. And then there's sort of the what I would describe as the Ukraine, Tunisia, Georgia model, where people don't tolerate it for very long at all. I don't know. Putin doesn't know. None of us know. And it could all start with some random incident, like a vegetable seller in Tunisia setting himself on fire.
And a Russian spring. Bill Browder's book, Red Notice, A True Story of High Finance, Murder, and One Man's Fight for Justice, is published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Browder, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
When the Cold War ended in 1991, international observers anticipated that the former Soviet Union would develop into a democratic Russia, but that never really happened. Instead, Vladimir Putin's Russia has gradually become increasingly repressive and aggressively authoritarian. Where did Russia's transition from a dictatorship to burgeoning democracy go wrong? Well, according to Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion and one of the current Russian opposition leaders, much of the blame lies with the United States and other Western nations who, through appeasement and complacency, have enabled Putin's rise. In his latest book, Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped, Mr. Kasparov explains Putin's ascension to power and asserts that he's become the world's greatest threat to peace, stability, and freedom. The book is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Garry Kasparov back to our show. Hello.
Thanks for inviting me.
You took your book's title from the Stark family's motto in Game of Thrones. What kind of winter should we be anticipating?
I'm a big fan of the books and the show, and I thought it was very appropriate. And actually, the publisher had the same opinion because it's almost unique when the publisher agreed to take a title without, you know, throwing 10 different suggestions on the table. It's not just about the climate, though I believe that the history also works in cycles. But it's about dark and dangerous times ahead of us. And the lengths of this geopolitical winter will depend very much on our ability or our inability to prepare for these times.
Well, we hear very often about how bad Vladimir Putin is, but we don't necessarily fear his Russia in the way that we fear the Soviet Union. What kind of existential threat do you say he poses?
Threats could change, you know, throughout the history, and naturally Putin's Russia is just a pale shadow of the Soviet Union, you know, if you set aside nukes, because there's still the same capacity to destroy human race many times over.
But he's as unlikely to use his nuclear weapons as the Soviet leaders were.
I would say the contrary.
Mutually assured destruction is not a concern?
Yes, it was a concern for the Soviet leaders because the Soviet Union was ideological dictatorship. And while, you know, it was a very dangerous regime, dangerous for the world, but it had certain stability based on the different interests of power groups that formed Politburo, Central Committee of the Communist Party. And I think the regime, if you may say, regime itself understood the threats of the nuclear confrontation. Putin's Russia is different. It's a full-blown one-man dictatorship where everything depends on one man. And this is the most unstable and dangerous form of governance because the man who is in charge, and he is literally all-powerful, he doesn't care what happens with the world if he goes. And if he's facing an uprising and the real threat of being torn in pieces in the Red Square, there's a much bigger chance that he could push this button while the Soviet leaders, you know, they always had a system of self-control, and if somebody could get crazy, there will be many others who could actually take this man from the panel.
Although there is a recent documentary about a man who saved us from missile war, destruction on both sides because of a computer malfunction.
But the malfunctions, you know, the glitches, we do understand. You know, when we have such powerful weapons, you know, it's even mechanical failure or computer glitch, you know, could lead to a disaster. But we're talking about the psychology of the leadership.
Right, so now, what drives Putin, do you think? Economic gamesmanship? Pure thirst for power? Do you think he has any kind of clear strategy for how to maintain and expand his power?
Putin doesn't have a strategy if we're talking about long-term plans, because a successful dictator, he knows that he must survive today, maybe tomorrow morning. The rest is not as important because it will be a new game. So Putin's strength is his tactical ability to survive and always to find, you know, the quick moves to make position even more complicated, if I can use chess terms.
So his goal is not to restore Russia to the prominence that the Soviet Union enjoyed?
It's not a goal, but it's ironically it's a tool, because he needs a justification for staying in power for so long, actually forever now. And since economy looks so bad and nobody in Russia actually expects it to get better, the idea of resurrecting the all-powerful Russia, Soviet Empire, Russian influence, protecting Mother Russia against endless enemies, those ideas, they basically form Putin's core ideology, and he needs crisis, ongoing crisis, permanent crisis in Russia, in the Russian immediate borders or elsewhere, like in the Middle East, to guarantee that his propaganda machine will be selling this mythology to the Russian public.
It's been pointed out that a quick switch to democracy after there has been a totalitarian state or serious or autocratic state is very difficult, whether it's in Russia or anywhere else. What kind of understanding did Russians have of democracy when they first voted in 1991?
I think the Russians, Soviet at that time, they understood very little about democracy as an institution, democracy as the balance of power, at the different branches that could control each other. All Russian Soviet people knew at that time was that the Western world had democracy as a system of governance, and they had a much better life there. So it's all about living standards. Soviet Union collapsed quickly because almost nobody wanted to defend the system that, you know, ran out of steam, the system that couldn't offer, you know, decent lives. So in the minds of ordinary Russians on the street, democracy had to guarantee high living standards. And when Yeltsin's democracy failed to meet these expectations, there was a huge disillusionment which helped Putin to turn the clocks back.
Would a different style of economic reform have supported democratic growth better than the shock therapy approach that occurred with the oligarchs suddenly taking over much of industry?
Absolutely.
How did they wind up being able to take over industry? Was it just you were luckily placed?
No, I don't think that, you know, if we discuss the mistakes made in the 90s, we could look on an economy separating politics. Because one of the biggest problems that we faced, biggest mistakes made by Yeltsin administration, was a decision to avoid sort of the you may call it cleansing operation, just to liquidate the Soviet institutions, and not just the Communist Party, but also the KGB and other, you know, tools of the Soviet regime, and to prevent any potential restoration, and also to offer ordinary Russians a chance to start their new businesses, and just not to be under heavy pressure of the state regulators.
He was pretty much unknown in the West when he came to power in 1999. How familiar were you with him at that time?
Oh, I have to tell you that he was pretty much unknown in Russia. So it's very few people knew the name before he appeared in Moscow as the head of the KGB after having a very, very low-key position in Yeltsin administration, and before he was a right-hand man of St. Petersburg Mayor Anatoly Sobchak. But for Russian public, the rise of Vladimir Putin, you know, just its meteoric rise of Vladimir Putin was a big surprise. And many in Russia, looking at Putin, you know, they thought, oh, maybe we could have a leader, a modern leader, a dynamic leader, somebody who's so different from Yeltsin. I mean, who was not looking convincing, I mean, just to be diplomatic. And people expected a fresh start, not even paying much attention to the fact that Putin was a KGB, and he was a proud KGB who said numerous times that there was no former KGB, once KGB, ever KGB.
And although the KGB's name was changed to the FSB.
Oh, that this organization changed names many times since 1917.
Yeah, the NKVD earlier.
Yes.
But has it really changed very much with the name changes?
No, the only change is that now you have many multimillionaires, if not billionaires, you know, in the ranks and files of this organization, because they very much control of every aspect of Russian political and economic life. But the methods still the same. They are defying the laws. They believe they're above the law, and I think that, you know, they could be even more powerful today because they have such a deep-rooted lobby of Putin's supporters based on their ability to buy these favors.
Although being very wealthy isn't always enough. Khodorkovsky learned that lesson.
But he was not KGB. That's exactly. Khodorkovsky actually built a company that that was independent from Kremlin's control, the most successful, the biggest Russian oil company, and he wanted to turn it into a multinational. Basically, he wanted to create, you know, an open cooperation with Western institutions and to remove a big chunk of Russian economy from the hands of Kremlin's Putin's cronies.
And, of course, that's what got him in trouble. What were the early signs during Vladimir Putin's presidency that he was moving Russia toward a more authoritarian system? Did they occur right away?
Look, we had many questions about apartment bombings in Moscow and Volgodonsk in 1999. We questions about the beginning of Second Chechen War and the role of KGB in all these tragic events. I wouldn't call it operations yet because you cannot prove it beyond reasonable doubt, but I think they were definitely involved. But also the Putin's first action as a president of Russia, his decision to bring back the Soviet anthem. It was purely symbolic, but I think it was kind of a Freudian message, you know. He was dreaming about restoration of the Soviet Union, and, you know, it was clear that given a if he was given a chance, he would miss it.
Now, could he have been stopped at any point along the way?
Oh, I believe there were many moments where, you know, decisive actions by the Western powers could prevent him from turning into, you know, Russia into...
What could they have done?
Look, Putin definitely, when he took over from Yeltsin, he didn't have this, you know, grandiose plans. I mean, his power was quite limited. Naturally, after taking over Yukos, destroying the largest Russian company and chopping it in pieces and giving these pieces to, I mean, very, you know, nice pieces of business to his friends, he became more powerful. But still, I think he was not sure about his future after 2008 because Russian constitution, you know, had, you know, two terms limitation. And I guess in 2007, there was a first moment, if not the last, where Putin could be advised not to stay in power forever.
By whom? Because what he did was simply trade jobs with Dmitry Medvedev.
No, he didn't trade jobs. You know, it was more of, you know, of having his puppet there because he knew he would come back. And for me, the clear indication of Putin's intention was his decision to stay within Russian power structure.
So does it matter whether he's the prime minister or the president?
No, it's in a mafia structure. You know, mafia boss doesn't have to be, you know, the man who has the highest job. Actually, even in the Soviet Union, when you look back, I mean, Stalin didn't keep the highest job because everyone knew was the boss, you know. But in 2006, 2007, Russia was in a different, say, geopolitical mood. Putin was looking for friends. And he became probably already the richest man on the planet. And I think the proper reaction from the from G7, okay, at that time G8 leaders could turn him around because he still had many options. You know, there was an exit strategy. He could release Khodorkovsky, pay whatever, you know, he thought was appropriate because oil jumped from $20 a barrel to $140 a barrel. And, you know, just to become the president of International Olympic Committee, he could buy any position in the international organizations he wanted. But, you know, it was too tempting for him to stay in power because nobody opposed him. And I think the moment when he saw that he could stay in power forever was his invasion of Republic of Georgia, where the Western response was very timid. And he understood that his plans of restoring Soviet Union and basically staying in charge of this newly built empire, they would not be met by an adequate response.
My guest is Garry Kasparov, whose latest book is not about chess. It's Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. It is published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Garry Kasparov. His latest book is Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. It is published by Public Affairs. How has he handled the economy? Of course, things were good when oil prices were up. Is he just a victim of the fact that there's an oil glut these days?
You may call him a victim. I think he sees this differently. He benefited dramatically from this rise of oil prices. And I think that's what, you know, helped him to sell Russian public the idea that his freedom is not as important as, you know, as a comfortable life. Because for many Russians, you know, sudden improvement in their normal life, you know, because of the high oil prices, was a sign that maybe Russia was a democracy at last.
But these days, things aren't as good for the Russian economy, and people are suffering, and yet the latest polls indicate that he has a near 90% approval rating.
Okay, but I think it's at one point we should understand that numbers like 90% or higher, or at that range, they probably are not reflecting the what people think, because in dictatorships, you have to incorporate in any ratings the factor of fear. You know, what are your expectations from people who are being called anonymously and asked about the dictator? And I'm always surprised that you still have people, 10%, 20%, that are comfortable saying that they didn't like him.
Forbes recently ranked Putin the number one most powerful person in the world. What do you think of that?
As much as I don't like this assessment, I think it's objective, because even if technically he's not the most powerful man, since I believe Obama, the president of the United States, has much more power in his hands, but the way Putin is willing to use his power, political will factor, I mean, makes him much more powerful, because no matter what Obama says, everyone knows he will not act.
You're highly critical of President Obama's handling of Putin and Russia. What's he doing wrong? Is he doing anything differently than George Bush did?
No, probably everything that he does vis-a-vis Russia was wrong from the very beginning, from this idea of reset policy after the invasion of Georgia. This is when the policy that was sunshine policy was introduced by him.
We should have a reset of U.S.-Russian relations
in 2009.
When he came to power.
Yeah, and they believed that they could play Medvedev against Putin, which I think was very naive. But, you know, I could tell you that it was not entirely the fault of this administration. I think it was a policy started by Clinton's administration that, you know, Soviet Union at that time, Russia already, was no longer a threat. So, and even if we didn't like, we Americans here, didn't like what was happening in Russia at a certain point, still Russia is more of a partner than an enemy, and we have to find a way of working with Russia. And Bill Clinton missed a big moment in 1995 to kill Iranian nuclear program at the very beginning, where he could just put an ultimatum to Yeltsin, and he decided it was probably not friendly, that we would not be dealing with Iranian nuclear program today.
Maybe because Russia was
exactly. It was the beginning of this Russian-Iranian cooperation, and U.S. Congress actually wanted Clinton to put, you know, an ultimatum saying, you know, unless Russia stops it, you know, the financial aid would be cut. And then, of course, you know, George W. Bush after 9/11, you know, he also thought that Putin could be an ally. You know, he looked at his famous phrase, he looked in his eyes, he saw his soul. And I always said that Bush had to look into his record. Again, Obama, I think, continued this development of U.S. policy, foreign policy, expecting Russia to sort of to be part of this global democratic concert.
Is the United States the only player in this? Because, as I understand it, there were concerns in Europe, many countries dependent on Russian oil and natural gas, that if we pushed Putin too hard, that they would wind up suffering as a result.
Look, America is still the leader of the free world. And, of course, what America does...
So Angela Merkel doesn't count? Her opinion
doesn't count? No, she's important. We can go back to Europe. She's definitely, you know... the most capable European politician. I always say she's the only European politician with balls these days. But let's not forget, I mean, this is, she is ruling the coalition government, and her foreign minister comes from the Social Democrats, Democratic Party, which is still influenced by former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, you know, has been Putin's longtime ally and working in Gazprom. Also, Angela Merkel has to take into account the position of German business. But speaking about Europe and Russia in terms of these trade relations, gas and oil, yes, Europe buys from Russia about one-third of its gas and oil, probably now less because they have been replacing it. Russia sells to Europe more than 80% of its gas and oil. So tell me who will suffer more, you know, if the conflict goes further.
You claim that the world would be a safer, more democratic place today if John McCain had been elected president over
John
Obama.
John McCain.
There's a joke in this country that anytime there's any kind of a problem in the world, John McCain says, let's go to war. Do you really think that it would... That would be a good idea.
You know, it says we should also, you know, make a clear difference between the rhetorics and actions. Ronald Reagan, you know, was considered by many so a warmonger. How many times he used American force outside of the country? If you look at four presidents following him, two Republicans and two Democrats, they used force many more times. But it's not about, you know, just.
Well,
not
they
about,
went after bigger countries. He went after Grenada and Panama, which
Reagan,
were really easy.
Reagan dealt with the Soviet Union. I mean, let's not forget, the Soviet Union was not Putin's Russia. And Reagan, you know, had to deal with a world where Soviet Union was still, you know, considered by many as, you know, as a force that could stop America anywhere the Soviet leaders wanted. Going back to this period, so this is to the 80s, and as I described in my book, it was Reagan's refusal to accept Gorbachev's very comprehensive nuclear deal in 1986, which forced Soviet leadership into real perestroika. Because 1 month after these failed negotiations in Reykjavik, Gorbachev called Andrei Sakharov, and brought him back from exile. And that was the beginning of sort of a free exchange of ideas in a communist country, and I always say that it's a false choice between war and peace. It's if you don't appease a dictator, if you don't make concessions, that's the only alternative is war. Between war and peace, there's a big territory which I call leadership.
But haven't a lot of sanctions been applied and causing a lot of trouble? Isn't that the way you oppose a guy like Putin when you don't want to go to war with him?
I couldn't agree more. Nobody talked about boots on the ground, but what could be done, you know, more effectively is to use real sanctions. Because right now we have...
You think these are fake sanctions?
Not fake, very mild, you know, because if when you look at the sanctions, you should see that there are actually two elements of sanctions. One is the immediate economic impact. The second is psychological impact, because people could understand that, you know, unless they change their behavior, unless the country, you know, does something, you know, the sanctions will not be lifted. Right now, many in Russia, I believe absolute majority, has no doubt that the sanctions will be lifted. If you are following, you know, the Russian propaganda machine, and they, you know, Putin's cronies, they do their job well in convincing Russian public, simply, you know, pointing out at the disagreements in Europe and about very powerful Putin's lobby in the West that has been arguing for sanctions to be lifted. And people recognize that, you know, they are not in a good shape, but they can wait for maybe 6 more months, sanctions will be lifted, because Putin was victorious all the time. He always, you know, prevailed. And many believe he'll prevail again. It's about dictators looking strong, being lucky, invincible. And Putin knows that he must invest all his resources in preserving this image.
Putin consistently spins U.S. sanctions as economic aggression in order to paint himself as Russia's savior. He's not the only enemy of the United States who does that. If the United States lifted all of its sanctions against Russia tomorrow, would the Russian economy begin to grow again?
No, not necessarily, because Russian economic problems started even before the sanctions.
There's little diversity. It's pretty much an oil-based economy.
Yes, but if sanctions are pointed at individuals and big corporations, and the sanctions are causing real damage, then you create some kind of nervousness among Russian elite about their future. Right now, you have Russian oligarchs that could be, cut from their, their fortunes in the West because they don't have visas to travel. But as long as their families can comfortably rule their business empires from Switzerland, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, they have very little incentives, if any, to rise against Putin. The same for Russian middle class in Moscow. Yes, life is probably not very comfortable, but again, there are very little expectations for sanctions to sustain for a long time.
You stood for the Russian presidency in 2008. Given everything that you said about the Russian electoral system, I'm assuming that you weren't in it to win. What were you hoping to achieve?
From the first day I entered, what people mistakenly call Russian politics, so for me it was more like standing for human rights and democracy, we knew that it was not about winning elections, it's about having elections. That was our goal. And, no one could appear on the ballot if Kremlin didn't want you to. And, it was one more demonstration that elections in Putin's Russia is nothing more than a charade.
But some people who have been in opposition to the government, some wind up in prison. Others have wound up either beaten or dead. How dangerous is it to oppose the current political structure in Russia?
You said it just now. So that's why, I'm here in New York. And
You're living in exile, in effect?
Yes. Well, I left Russia in February 2013, and it was not my first choice. But, if I wanted to stay free and alive, I realized that there was no other choice but to leave the country. And I did it, upon the advice of my very close friend and ally, Boris Nemtsov, who advised me strongly not accepting the quote-unquote invitation from Russian Investigative Committee to show up and to talk about some of our political cases, because as he said, you enter the building as a witness, and if you leave the building, most likely you will be a suspect. Unfortunately, Boris hasn't followed his own advice. Hmm. He was the bravest of all of us. He stayed in Russia, and he was gunned down in front of the Kremlin last February.
What do you think Russia has to gain by supporting Iran and the Assad government? Is it simply a matter of being in opposition to the United States?
I have to change the question. What Putin? Russia has Putin. Nothing to gain. It's Russia actually has been losing strategically, both against China, against Islam, because Putin's policy, doesn't take into account, Russian strategic interests. Now, Putin, a lot. First of all, he's supporting one of the last dictators in the region, and it's very important for him after what's happened to Gaddafi, so just to demonstrate that the dictator brotherhood still works. Also, he shows that while America is not protecting its allies, long-term allies, Putin always sticks to his friends. Also, crisis in the Middle East could help Putin to push oil prices higher, especially if he succeeds in, together with Iranians, to push ISIS, Islamic State, down south against Saudi Arabia. And the last, not least, he sees great benefits of pushing Syrian refugees to Europe, because this wave of refugees in European countries directly helps his main allies in Europe, ultra-nationalist groups, to gain more power and eventually to help him to lift up European sanctions.
You argue that Putin is a Russian problem. Russians must deal with how to remove him. That doesn't seem very likely right now.
Look, it doesn't seem very likely right now because Putin seems to be all-powerful. What we know from history is that dictators can fall when and after the geopolitical defeat, and the defeat elsewhere, so in Syria or on other foreign fronts, could change Putin's invincible image overnight.
We're pretty much out of time, but just one more question. Do you still play chess?
Oh, yeah. Chess was a passion of my life, and I'm still spending about one-third of my time promoting chess for education to promote the game.
Do you see politics as a form of chess?
Chess helps me to sort of identify my moves, but in politics we don't have the same strict rules as in the game of chess.
Garry Kasparov's book, Winter is Coming, Why Vladimir Putin and the Enemies of the Free World Must Be Stopped. It is published by Public Affairs, and I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Times reported today that Dagestan, Russia's southernmost republic, has become a vital recruiting ground for the Islamic State. There are estimates that at least 2,000 fighters from the Caucasus are among the up to 7,000 recruits from Russia now in Syria and Iraq. The threat of ISIS and its reach in Europe will bring together Presidents Francois Hollande, Barack Obama, and Vladimir Putin, among others, to discuss the formation of a large coalition, although that coalition faces many hurdles, not the least of which are Putin's position on Bashar al-Assad, the seizure of Crimea, and his ultimate motives in Ukraine. Joining us now is former NBC newsman Marvin Kalb, an expert on national security and U.S. relations with Russia, Europe, and the Middle East. His latest book, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, is published by Brookings Institution Press. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here with you.
In the wake of the downing by ISIS of a Russian Metrojet airliner over Egypt's Sinai Desert last month, is Putin finally coordinating his attacks on ISIS with the West?
I don't think so. I think what he's trying to do right now is to feel for what is best for Russia. And at this particular point, there is no evidence that he has aligned Russia's interests with those of France and the United States. And at this particular point, I suspect what he is doing more than anything else is trying to make sure that the decision he made to commit military force into Syria was the right decision.
Russia is reported to have launched KH-101 long-range cruise missiles that reportedly pack an 800-pound warhead and
yes,
can fly 1,700 miles under satellite guidance. Is Putin using the airstrikes in Syria to show the West some of his newest weapons?
Well, I think his motivation—
Kind of like the May Day parade?
No, absolutely. And he is showing off Russian military might, because when he took over in the year 2000, one of the things that he wanted to do immediately was to take the Russian military, which had been in a state of absolute disintegration as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the collapse of communism in 1991. And throughout the 1990s, Russia could have been taken to the cleaners overnight. And when Putin came in, that is not going to happen, is the first thing he said. And he took the first budget that he put before his, quote, Duma, the parliament, was a budget that had an enormous amount of money directed toward rebuilding the Russian military.
And now the Russian space program seems to be pretty much the only space program. The United States relies on it despite all the tensions.
Yeah, and that is really something that's a whole other world. But we can somehow or another take our ego and put it in our hip pocket and walk away from the problem and lean on the Russians, knowing full well that the Russian space program never really was as good in a sophisticated technological way as the American space program.
But it's a matter of who wants to spend the money.
Exactly. And the U.S. at this point is simply against the spending of money for this purpose.
Putin's allegiance to President Bashar al-Assad seems pretty strong. Can you explain why he seems to be so unwilling to agree to a transitional government that wouldn't include Assad?
Well, let's be clear about that point. What we know right now is what the articulated Russian position is, and that is that the Russians have gone into Syria in a major military way in order to build up Assad and to make sure he does not collapse. But we really don't know whether, at the end of the day, which is characteristic of Putin's entire operation, at the end of the day, if he believes that a deal would be in Russia's national interest, he would get rid of Assad overnight. He has already said to any number of diplomats in the last 6 months, quote, I am not wedded to Assad.
And you keep on making that point that his main concern is Russia's
yes.
best interests. But shouldn't he be concerned that so many Russian citizens have joined the fight against Assad? Isn't it likely that some of them will return to Russia and do something similar to what's happened in Paris?
Leonard, I think that question, and I thank you for it, leads us directly into a discussion, in my judgment, leads us directly into a discussion about the strength that Putin now has as a political leader in Russia. My own gut feeling is that his move into Syria has opened him to being highly vulnerable, and vulnerable because one of the things that we as Americans tend to forget is that Russia today is a country of 144 million people, a vast country stretching from Poland to the Pacific.
But that's still half the population, or less than half the population, of the United States.
Exactly. But think about 144 million, of whom 21 million are Sunni Muslim. The Sunni Muslims live for the most part in the Northern Caucasus. In the last 20 years, they have demonstrated their capacity for terrorism within Russia, and there has been a major war, two major wars with Chechnya. In Dagestan, just south of Chechnya, that place could blow in a day. And you mentioned before 7,000 Russian fighters. Technically, they're not Russian. Technically, there are only about 2,500 who come from Russia and who are Russian citizens. The other, building up to the 7,000, come out of what used to be Soviet Central Asia, where 68 million Sunni Muslims live. They are in opposition to the idea that Putin can use Russian power to bomb Sunni Muslims in Syria. They are the same people as the Sunni Muslims in Russia. And if you listen, as I've tried to do as often as possible, to what Sunni clerics are saying in Dagestan, in Chechnya, in Central Asia, they sound almost like ISIS. Very, very close.
They live, many of them, in abject poverty, on subsistence
exactly.
farming. Would perhaps a bit more investment in their area by Putin alleviate some of this tension?
Yes, but that would mean that he's got the money and the desire to help these people. He has, as most Russians do, I don't want to say they have contempt for the Muslim minority in Russia, but they're not interested in them. The Muslim minority, as a matter of fact, if you go back 200 years and you begin to think about what the great writers of Russia wrote, Tolstoy, Turgenev, all of these people in the early 19th century, they wrote about their wars with the Sunni Muslims in the southern part of Russia. Some of Pushkin's and some of Tolstoy's greatest works reflect an awareness that the Slav Christian is at war with the Muslim in what is nevertheless Russia.
Some of Putin's ministers have said that there's a flow of sewage from the Caucasus to Syria, and that they've been accused of letting the Sunnis flow into the Middle East out of their region. They're calling them sewage.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is the contempt that a lot of Russians have for the Muslim population of the country. We really have to be mindful of the many times in the last 20, 25 years that Sunni Muslims, Russians, operating in Russia, their native land, have used terrorism as the tactic against Russian authority, against Slavic authority. This is something that is in their minds, and the reason I think that Putin right now is vulnerable, really for the first time since 2000, is that he is ignoring, and I can't figure out why, he is ignoring this building restive unhappiness in one out of seven Russian citizens. That's a big deal.
I'm speaking with Marvin Kalb, his latest book, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War. Do you have a sense of what may be achieved in this meeting next Tuesday between the world leaders and finding a way to end the Syrian conflict?
I think that it is possible, if there is to be a major shift in policy, either by Obama or by Putin, unless there's a major shift, nothing is going to happen. A lot of talk.
Will Russia demand in exchange for progress in Syria, some easing of the sanctions that were imposed post-Crimea and Ukraine?
Of course, that is part of the deal, obviously. If Putin is going to strike some kind of compromise with the West and give up on Assad, he's going to want something in return. And what he wants in return, I don't want to say more than anything, but in a very significant way, what he wants is for somehow or other, for the West Europeans to forget about Ukraine, forget about Crimea, let the Russians simply have it. And we have to say thank you, Mr. Putin, for easing up on the Syrian war. That, my gut feeling right now, that is not going to happen.
Now, I was surprised to see how popular Putin remains. Why doesn't the Russian public blame him for the hardships that they're enduring as a result of the sanctions for his actions?
Well, that's another one of those very good questions. Number
one, I'm trying to ask good questions today.
I know you're very good at that, I know. But as a matter of fact, I ought to tell you what I told your producer, that we writers who operate in the Washington, D.C. area, and we have to go around promoting our book, we want more than anything, we get up to New York, to be on your show. So that's
a high compliment
that I can pay you. To get to...
Yeah, why is he remains so popular? Is it just that he controls propaganda?
But how do we know he's that popular? We go by... mostly by the Levada polling operation in Moscow. And I'm asking myself, you are with this organization, you knock at a Russian's door in Moscow, you say, how do you do? I'm with a professional polling organization. I really want to know, do you like your president or don't you? What are you going to say? So you've got up to 86%, it is said, of the Russian people. I don't buy that at all. Right now, if you widen the focus and go beyond Moscow and go beyond Petersburg, you find a country with a lot of very small strikes, a country where people who are supposed to be paid every week are now being paid every month, where people are wondering whether they're returning to the tough days of yesteryear.
Yeltsin years.
In the Yeltsin years, they were reasonably good. I'm thinking even further back. Right now, the Russian people, my gut tells me, and a lot of reading and talking tell me, that there's a lot of unhappiness. But, oddly, given the nature of the Russian psyche, they're not necessarily blaming Putin for that. Putin has managed to turn the public mind around so that the Russians think if there's a problem, it's because of the West.
The West is picking on
The West them. Is the bad guy they're picking on, especially the United States.
You write about the hostile relationship between Putin and Obama. Did they have an instant dislike to each other? Was there ever a time that they got along the way George Bush seems to have when he said about Putin, I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul, a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country.
Obama has never had that same experience that George W. Bush had. Obama and Putin have had, almost from the very beginning, a testy relationship. And we have to understand that Obama and Putin both came back into power as presidents at a time when the entire world was reeling from an economic crisis. We're going back to 2009. And it was not in Obama's interest at that time, or really in his interest, both psychologically and politically, to get along with this tough guy from Russia. He needs us, Obama felt, a lot more than we need him. And from the very beginning, Putin sort of picked this up and responded. I'm not saying it's the president's fault. I'm saying only that the two men came together, and as happens often enough, They simply, there was a lot of sandpaper in the relationship, and they didn't like each other.
Because of their history, might Putin be even more angry if Hillary Clinton is elected our next president?
Not necessarily.
Didn't she really anger him?
No, but when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she actually, to the degree that she had dealings with Putin, she actually got along reasonably well with him. And she tried very hard to deal with him on a level that he understood. She never went after him on a small point involving Middle East policy. She dealt with him on things that she knew he cared about.
But she supported the anti-Putin demonstrations in 2011, 2012, and that
and
really angered
him. And he ripped into her for that, absolutely. But she could only have done that because that was something to be supported. That was the Russian people standing up at long last and saying enough.
Marvin Kalb is a senior fellow with the Foreign Policy Program at Brookings and a senior advisor at the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. He is a former NBC newsman, where he also served as chief diplomatic correspondent, Moscow bureau chief, and host of Meet the Press. He was also the founding director of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy, the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And his latest book is Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, published by the Brookings Institute. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Marvin Kalb, whose latest book, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, is published by the Brookings Institution Press. When President Obama first took office, a time that he felt he had to reset U.S. policy toward Russia because Putin had accepted, at least on paper, the lesser position of prime minister, and Dmitry Medvedev was really the new president. How real was that whole situation?
It was real, but it didn't mean all that much because Putin, even as prime minister, determined the basic line of policy, and he allowed Medvedev more or less to take care of the daily dealings of government. But the thrust of foreign policy, the thrust of domestic policy, remained essentially the same as it had been in Putin's first 8 years.
But we had certain concerns in common at that time because war was still being waged in Afghanistan. Terrorism was a problem for both countries. There had been nuclear arms talks. And then things suddenly went bad? They went sour?
Well, there were a lot of reasons to believe they would likely go bad when Putin came back. But what Putin found when he came back was that enough of the Russian people had become so fed up with what it is that Putin represented in Russia, that they began to have demonstrations. In those demonstrations, which took place in 2011 and 2012, during which time Putin was, quote, reelected as president in a totally phony election, there were enough Russians who said, we've got to do something which Russians don't usually do, and that's to go out on the street and demonstrate in an angry way, determined that they would get their way by a show of force. Well, Putin shut it down very fast.
Well, people were killed. Others were jailed.
Absolutely.
People were beaten up.
Absolutely. And he didn't think twice about doing that. Because for Putin, and it's, by the way, a central point in the book Imperial Gamble, is for Putin, you don't mess around with his understanding of political power. You do not mess around with established power. And by the way, that takes us back to the Middle East. Putin's idea of helping Assad is you cannot allow the mob, all of the people opposing Assad, to kick out an established ruler. Because in Putin's mind, again, the Russian people could stand up and say, Mr. Putin, we've had enough of you. And at that particular point, the fear enters any Russian leader's mind that the people will one day rise up against me and I have therefore no authority at all.
Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, has said of Putin that he must live on another planet, but According to what you write here, there's a clear logic to his behavior, including some of the most outrageous behavior, like stripping to the waist and flexing his muscles and riding horseback across the Siberian steppes and being photographed with wild animals.
There is a Russian word, vozhd, which means leader, but generally it connotes the idea of a powerful Russian leader. He wants to be a powerful Russian leader in the tradition of Peter the Great.
Not Catherine the Great.
No. Although you buy that either. But also, even Stalin. And I describe him really as a mix of Peter the Great and Stalin. They both shared a desire to project the image of Russia's greatness and its glory. At the same time, they would crack down on any kind of counter political operation. And for Putin, a crowd that is his crowd is a good crowd. But a crowd that he did not organize or give permission to is a hostile crowd and potentially a crowd that could bring him down. That's why he has to be careful of disenchantment on the part of the Russian people and the degree of active hostility on the part of the Russian Muslims.
You say he's created the image of the good Russian through some of these antics. How did his homophobic side play on all of this? Is this really just more of the same machismo that he's creating?
Yeah, it's more of that, but it also fits in with a certain image of Russian political life, which is that you have men running things, powerful men, and women have their place in society, but only if they understand that place.
And there's the declining birth rates in
Russia. Very much.
So this is a way of turning things around?
It certainly is one of the reasons, without any doubt. It's one of the reasons, but it's not the central reason. The central one was that he wanted to come through to the Russians as a vozhd, just this powerful figure that all Russians can look up to. Russians have traditionally, it's not just Putin, by the way, Putin is operating in an old Russian tradition of strong central authority. That idea goes back to the Mongols, and it is something that right now, even Russian intellectuals, I have many friends in Russia, and one of the areas of acute disagreement is when I ask them, how do you put up with this stuff? I mean, come on.
Does it feel all that different from when you were the Moscow bureau chief?
They are not that different at all. It's very much a continuation of that same idea that the Vozhd knows what he's doing. Leave him alone. Let him do good things for all of us.
It's like in the old days when they came and took your uncle and people would say, does Uncle Joe Stalin know that they're doing this terrible thing? They just assumed that he would have been as outraged as they were when, in fact, of course, he was behind it.
Absolutely. And that is the exact same thing now with Putin. If you left New York and flew into Moscow and then decided to go further out into Chelyabinsk somewhere, you would find that Russians there have the same general attitude as the attitude conveyed by Russian television and Russian radio. It's all a reflection of the Putin policy line, that if you've got a problem, you don't blame the Vozhd. He's doing the best he can for you. You've got to blame the West and the United States. They're up to little shenanigans, and we got to be careful about them.
My guest is Marvin Kalb, whose latest book is Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, published by the Brookings Institution Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the most surprising things I learned from your book is how few Russian experts and scholars exist in the West today. After the Cold War, did academia just shut down Russian studies departments?
They didn't necessarily shut them down, but if they had to fill it in with another person to teach Russian history, they felt it was not important. A place like Harvard University, which is pretty good as an academic institution, did not have a senior scholar teaching Russian history in the 1990s.
We used to have all those Kremlinologists.
Yeah, well, the Kremlinologists existed in the U.S. government. But what is very interesting is that from the period of 1991, when the Soviet Union disintegrated and communism died as a major force in the world, there were very few places that determined it important enough to study what was going on in Russia. They simply lived with this guy named Boris Yeltsin. They couldn't take him seriously. When Putin first came over, George W. Bush had this very positive impression of him because nobody, well, that's an exaggeration, because there were too few people looking at the history of Russia, looking at what it was that was likely going on, how can we best deal with this to make it better for the United States? We didn't have that, and it was a bloody shame.
Does it require really understanding history to understand what happened with Crimea? I spoke to some Russians after it was seized, and they said, well, it's been part of Russia forever. Well, the fact of the matter is, it was became part of the Russian Empire when Catherine the Great took it from the Turks in 1783. That's not all that long ago. And then from 1954 to 2014, it was part of Ukraine given to it by Khrushchev. So,
well, that was Crimea.
I meant to say yeah. Crimea. I'm sorry.
And but the point here is a very, very important one, and that is. Just to back up a sec, when I was thinking of writing Imperial Gamble, the first thing that went to my mind was to go back and read the basic texts of Russian history. And there are no basic texts of Ukrainian history. There's a good reason for that. And that is that it was not until recent years that people took the concept of Ukraine as a completely independent nation.
Even though they speak a somewhat different language?
They speak a somewhat different, but, you know, it's not that far as comparing the difference between South Texas and North Maine. It's not really that much
because
of a difference.
Kiev was originally part of the whole concept of Russia, wasn't it?
No, Kiev was called by Russian historians the first Russia. The second Russia came in with Moscow development in about the 16th century. At that time, it was essentially a matter, the Mongols had moved through in the 13th century and leveled Kiev. So the people who lived there had to go somewhere, and many of them ended up in the region of Moscow. And right now, to understand the context of Ukraine's thoroughly legitimate yearning for acceptance as an independent nation, you've got to understand that for most of its life, it was part of a Russian empire, writ large and writ loosely, by which I mean that borders were not all that important between the two.
But isn't the argument that Crimea is still logically a part of Russia because 60% of the people who live there are Russian? Doesn't that have some validity?
I think so. I think that if you were to go way, way back, it was Vladimir, one of the first princes of the Kiev what they call Kievan Rus, he decided that the best way of striking a deal with the Turks was to marry a Turkish woman. And the only way he could do that was to Christianize both himself and all of Kievan Rus, and which is exactly what he did.
Now, you have described Putin's reign as a kleptomaniacal aristocracy.
Yes.
It's often called a kleptocracy. Is this like what we see in some third world countries where the leader just takes as much money and puts it off in a Swiss bank somewhere?
I don't know whether Putin himself does that, but his strength is derived from the loyalty of a small group of people who came with him from Leningrad down to Moscow in the late 1990s. The reason they have their power is not just that they're close to Putin, but it is because they control the entire Russian economy. They are incredibly wealthy, and they are people who steal from morning till night. It is said, without any confirmation, that Putin has already stashed away $40 billion. Who knows if that's true? I mean, he'll probably be able to get by with one.
You're right that President Obama, just to get under Putin's skin, will refer to Russia as just a regional power.
Exactly.
And Putin wants to be thought of as the leader of the same other great power that the Soviet Union was during the Cold War?
Very much so. I have a feeling that the president did that in order to just to continue to get under his skin and to make him realize that he's not the great power he thinks he is.
And defenders of Putin in the West say that the West is responsible to some degree because of the expansion of NATO into the area.
I think there is a lot of truth to that. In the 1990s, my very, very dear friend at that time, no longer with us, Bill Sapphire, who wrote for the New York Times, in the mid-1990s, Bill was very much for the extension of NATO to get as close to Russia as humanly possible. And I said to him at that point, Bill, I think you're pushing this line too far. And he said something like, Marvin, he said, you're an idealist. He says, you don't realize that in politics, when the guy is down, kick him.
That's
and that
too.
Is what was sort of the philosophy roughly stated in the U.S. government and in Western Europe, that Russia was down and we should put our boot on Russia. And what Putin is saying now is that you guys blew it because you put your boot down on us and we will never forget it. So that created for Putin the hostility that today he has turned into a policy.
And now other countries, and not just Ukraine, but Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, or to some degree even Poland, are concerned that Putin might very well want to expand again.
Yeah, and I think they have every right in the world to be concerned about it. Whether Putin wants to and whether Putin can becomes two very large issues. At this point, the Russian economy is up the creek without a paddle, and Putin himself has so many acute problems crushing down on his ability to govern. This is a huge country, and it's going to be very difficult for Putin to manage, especially if there is an upsurge once again of Sunni Muslim-led terrorism in Russia.
Marvin Kahl began his reporting career in the 50s as one of Murrow's boys. He had a very distinguished career at NBC. He is now at the Brookings Institution, among
yes.
other places. You want to go through the full CV, or should I just say
no? No, I don't want to do the thing at all. I just want to say that I am a very fortunate man to be able at this age to continue to be absorbed with living issues and to write books which I hope are worthy of being read, and to teach both at Harvard and GW at Brookings all over the place. I like that very much. God gave me a good turn.
And the latest book is Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, published by Brookings Institution Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard. I appreciate that.